Hey everybody, welcome to the Dreamer's Edge podcast.
With Nicholas, I'm the gaming correspondent for Idiomatic.
And I am Dimitri, editor-in-chief of Idiomatic and movie critic. Now I know what you're thinking, where are Frank, Chris, and Eric? Why are the bozos from Don't F With The Original here? Well, The Wolverine is coming out this Friday, and Nick and I already talked about the original Wolverine movie over at Don't F With The Original. However, that flick was a prequel, whereas the new movie follows the events of the third X-Men movie. And we're already at number 6. So, we thought we'd take over the Dreamer's Edge podcast and discuss where the franchise left off with X-Men The Last Stand.
Well, Jean Grey has just died in the previous movie, spoiler alert. And everybody's dealing with that. She somehow comes back to life, and she causes a bunch of mischief. Parallel to that, there's a cure that has been found for mutancy. And so you get the cure and you're no longer a mutant. So you basically have two parallel plots. The cure being seen by Magneto as something very bad. And Jean Grey doing very bad stuff. And the X-Men have to stop both of these things. You know, Magneto doing causing some trouble and Jean Grey.
Yeah.
And I make it sound like it's two separate movies, because it is. The stories really don't intertwine anyhow at all.
Well, they intertwine, they just don't really dovetail into each other. They do intertwine.
Yeah, that's true. They intertwine, they just don't, they don't mix.
Well, it's sort of fitting in a way, because, you know, all the X-Men movie always start with, like, Professor X doing his little speech while they have this little computer-generated montage of a double helix DNA thing.
Yeah.
It's like, and yeah, I mean, the plot structure of X-Men The Last Stand is sort of like a double helix. It's where you have two parallel lines that sort of spin around each other but never actually touch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, not crazy about this movie, I gotta tell you. I mean, it's been out for a while. It's generally despised by comic book fans. I am a huge X-Men fan since the 90s. I've been reading comics since then. And still do today.
Yeah.
And I gotta tell you, I was really frustrated with this movie. Not because it doesn't respect the comic, because I don't care. Like, X-Men 1 and 2 doesn't really respect the comic that much. It respects the spirit, but not the actual content, if you will.
Exactly.
But I was sitting there just in mild disbelief at just how shallow and stupid this movie is.
The two stories are very, very basic. One thing I didn't like is that they had so many characters that were established in the first movies, and they just chose not to use them. Like, I know it was a contract thing, but Cyclops, we get rid of him at the beginning of the movie. A Rogue, you see her, you know, taking the cure, and then that's it. You don't see her at all. She was a big character in the first two movies. They don't use her at all.
Yeah, well, she's been replaced by the new model called Kitty Pryde.
Yes.
She's been replaced in more ways than one when you think about it, because, like, Iceman sort of stops seeing Rogue for some reason and starts hooking up with Kitty Pryde for no bloody reason.
Exactly.
And it was like, oh, poor Anna Paquin Rogue. She's like the Rudy Huxtable of the Xavier Institute.
Mystique is another one. She was so awesome in the first two movies, and they completely destroy her character. I was like, why do you have all those established characters and you think, oh, we're going to have stuff happen to them that's just going to destroy them completely? It's ridiculous.
Was she destroyed? I mean, like, obviously something happens to her that changes her situation severely.
Yeah.
But I find the core of her character remains the same.
When you think Mystique, you think a kick-ass action scene when she kicks a lot of butt.
She does that, though.
Mm.
In the truck. In the truck, she kicks butt quite a bit before...
She kicks the butt of one guy, that's it, you know?
Yeah, but she does kick them.
Compare that to X2, where she infiltrates the facility and she, like, kicks the butt of a whole army by herself.
Well, yeah, but I'm not a big believer of the constant escalation, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it was 4 guys in the first movie, it's gotta be 8 in the second, and the third one's gotta be 25. Like, that's how X-Men 3 got into trouble with that escalation thing. We got this many villains in the first movie, second movie has more, third has gotta be even more. That's how you get into trouble. I'm fine. As long as she kicks butt, and she didn't kick 2 pair of buttockses, that's 4 half asses.
Yeah, I guess.
That's 4 cheeks and all.
And Magneto is really the worst one. He just completely changes, and he's just a bad guy now. He's not even the Magneto from the comics, which were, I'm doing this for mutant rights. He's just, I'm a bad guy now.
Yeah, and that's the big problem, because Magneto in the movies especially, and in the comics as well, because it's such a core of the character, he's sort of Malcolm X, if you will. He's the guy who goes like, oh yeah, Xavier is doing some progress for mutant kind, but like, what's progress mean when it comes to discrimination? You know, there's this famous Malcolm X line where it's like, you know, does it matter if it's 2-inch or 6-inch in my back? It's still a knife in my back, you know? And that's sort of Magneto's attitude towards it. Until you remove that knife, he is not satisfied. And in this third movie, he's like walking around going like, oh, well, you know, I'm using these mutants as pawns. And it's like, and the Magneto introduced in the first two movies would never do that. He does not sacrifice any mutant, including the X-Men. He's always so bloody reluctant to kill the X-Men, even though they're the ones who keep screwing his plans.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And in that one's like, yeah, we let the pawns go first so they get killed. I'm like, oh, that's odd.
Because the cure becomes weaponized eventually, which was his main concern, is that the government, the anti-mutant American government, would use the cure as a weapon, and one of the key mutants in the Brotherhood gets depowered.
Yeah.
And he goes like, oh, well, you're not a mutant anymore. I don't care about you. Bye-bye. It's like, you are the weakest link.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's so weird because you could have rewritten that in a way that was much more in character if he would have just used that mutant as his poster child for his cause. Where it's like, look what they did to this mutant. This mutant used to be glorious and powerful and awesome, and look what they turned this mutant into. And you could have had that mutant going like, what am I, chopped liver all of a sudden? Yeah, like, yeah. It would have been in character with Magneto. It would have been a little bit on the evil side, but totally, you know, still defendable.
Yeah. I agree. Again, it's nitpicking, really, but the scientist in me really got annoyed when he moved the San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, and the bridge didn't fall apart. Suspension bridges don't work that way. If you break the cables, the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah, here's what kills me about it, because he uses it to get to Alcatraz at one point, and then he proceeds to try to destroy Alcatraz. And I'm like, if you could do that, you could have just dropped the bridge on Alcatraz. Just saying.
Yeah.
You know? It's like it's a couple meters more, you know?
They added a bunch of new characters that amounted to almost nothing. I mean, I know he had a cameo in X2, but...
Colossus?
Yeah, he has a bigger role in this movie. You know, I guess he's the replacement for Cyclops, but what can you say about Colossus, really?
Does he have a bigger role, or is it just that he's in the final fight?
You know, the final fight is a pretty big role.
And is it? Well, in X-Men 3, I don't think it is.
Like, I guess.
They don't have characters. They're just extras in the final fight.
Yeah. Oh, he's at the beginning, too, and they're fighting Sentinels for some reason in the Danger Room.
Oh, yeah, I love that scene. I really do. I love that scene where they're fighting the Sentinel in the Danger Room, and, like, it turns out it's a simulation. Ooh, spoiler alert. Yeah. And I'm like, why do you need to fight giant robots as a training? Like, do you expect the Xavier Institute to be attacked by Mecha Godzilla anytime soon? Like, it seems like the most random course.
Where would you get even the idea, you know, oh, this is a training exercise, so let's program giant robots? I mean, it's ridiculous.
I know, like the new X-Men come into the field, fight evil mutants, go on, and they keep shooting too high.
Yeah.
It's like, I wasn't trained for 6 foot tall people.
Yeah. I know it's fan service. You know, okay, the fans wanted to see Sentinels. Okay, so it's a little, you know, wink to them. Then that doesn't explain when they added the Juggernaut. So, yeah, at one point he's fighting and he gets stopped and he says, "You think you can stop me?" And everybody's expecting him to say, "Nothing can."
Nobody can stop the Juggernaut!
Yeah.
Freaking fanboy moment right there,
exactly,
man.
And then he just says,
I'm the Juggernaut, bitch.
I mean, what is that? If you're gonna do the fan service with the giant robots at the beginning, at least do that with the Juggernaut. I mean, consistency.
Yeah, it's a missed opportunity. I mean, like, this is a small detail. Obviously, it's not the sort of thing where I would, you know, lower my appreciation of the film because of it. But it was one of those moments where you're like, so much of this film, as you pointed out, is just fan service. It's like, okay, let's put Spike into the movie, and let's put Omega Kid in the movie, and let's put Multiple Man in the movie. And I'm like, why? They don't do anything. Who cares? It's like, it's just so they can be in the movie.
Let's put Calypso in the movie, even though we don't even name her.
And now I had to go on the official website of the film to figure out what the name of her character is, because it's the only place where it's written.
Yeah. Never mentioned, and her only use is to basically give levels to mutants.
like freaking Pokemon. It drives me so nuts.
Levels were never explained.
He's like, oh, there's a level 6 mutant and an alpha level mutant. It's like, it's so weird. Like, how do you compare a guy with wings with a girl who passes through walls? Like, and why does she never explain how many experience points it takes for Kitty Pryde to turn into a Raichu? I'm just saying.
Yeah. They add Kelsey Grammer as Beast. A few jokes here and there, but, you know, besides that.
He does his Beast talk. You know what I mean? Like, he talks like the Beast, and then he doesn't do anything else.
Yeah. You know.
He's a great casting, by the way. That's what kills me.
I know.
Kelsey Grammer as Beast was genius.
That was great casting, and you were looking forward to seeing that. And no, he does nothing.
Like, oh, the Pyro. Pyro was the biggest, that's the biggest frustration for me.
Yeah.
Pyro was in the second movie in X2 X United. He was built as such a well-rounded character. The villain who you feel sorry for because he's clearly making a bad decision in his life, but for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
You know? And he comes back in the third movie with absolutely no loyalty to his former friends. He's just like this wicked little creature, just out to do harm for the heck of it. It's like, what are you? Why are you so two-dimensional?
Yeah, what happened to you? You lost one dimension between 2 and 3.
No.
He was my favorite character in the second movie. And all of a sudden, you know, I would have killed Xavier if you had told me to. No, you wouldn't have.
No! And he's only used so he can have, like, this little Mortal Kombat moment with Iceman in the final fight where they shoot special effects at each other and you're like, because one controls fire and one controls ice, and so you get steam and you're like, yay.
Yay.
It's like, all right. What'd you get? When you get Pyro versus Iceman, you get a Peter Gabriel video.
Yeah, now I'm thinking of the video Steam, and yeah, it's even more ridiculous. You have a talent of reminding me of stuff, and you know, ruining stuff for me like that.
These are things that we noticed because we were completely not invested in the movie.
Yeah.
These are not things that really take down the movie a notch, really necessarily. Well, the character thing is something that takes the movie down a notch, but the biggest problem is that we're noticing all these little details because we have nothing to hold on to. The story is just so ephemeral. It's because, like you said, there's two plots. So plot one, let's discuss plot one, The Cure.
Yes.
With Magneto. So as we mentioned, the way the character is written doesn't feel like Magneto, but his agenda is actually defendable. Because the idea here is that there's a mutant cure, there's an offer to cure mutants from being mutants. And Magneto sees that as an affront because he's afraid they're going to weaponize it, which they do.
Yeah.
And he also feels like, why are you changing the basic makeup of who I am? Like, that's discrimination. And his point of view is defendable.
Yeah, that's also easy for him to say since he has, like, super powerful, you know, he controls magnetism and he can do really cool stuff as opposed to, you know, say a certain person who can't touch people or else they die. Maybe they'd like the cure. Just saying.
It's not really Magneto's concerns because Magneto doesn't have to be 100% right. That's why he's the villain.
Yeah, that's true.
His view can be extreme. But the problem is that the X-Men sort of have that same stance where they're trying to be in the middle and they're like, well, yeah, but, like, it's okay as long as they don't weaponize it, but then they have conflict within, and Storm takes this really, really aggressive stance, was like, they're trying to change who we are, and, like, and blah, 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 and she starts scolding Rogue for wanting to get the cure. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the movies, Rogue's power is to absorb the personality, the memories and the powers of anyone she touches to the point that it drives her half mad. And the other person goes into a coma in the meantime. She really wants to do it with Iceman and she can't. And he's starting to look at Kitty Pryde. Yeah. And she's thinking, you know what? Maybe it'd be nice if I didn't have to, you know, every time I want to hold my boyfriend's hand, have to put a life-size condom on myself.
Yeah.
And that seems reasonable to me.
Yeah. Completely. So, you know, having the cure and, you know, having her just, you know, point out that, yeah, it might be a good thing. It kind of totally destroys the X-Men's, the cure is wrong. This is who we are. There's nothing wrong with us.
Well, Storm specifically, because she gets really aggressive about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can control the weather and you're super powerful. Of course, there's nothing wrong with you besides your acting. But poor Rogue who is suffering because of her powers, and then she gets yelled at by Rogue in addition to that. You're like, wow, this is already a good start.
Because, you know, freedom is about doing what liberals want you to do.
Exactly. And she rants, she rants to Wolverine as well.
You're not a team player. You're not a team player. And it's like he just got out, like, literally, in the movie, he just got out of bed. Like, he comes down the stairs and goes like, well, maybe Broke has a point. And he goes like, you're not a team player. When are you going to take a stance? And I'm like, dude, can I just get an orange juice this morning first? Like, and the Moon never really tries to balance that out is the big problem. Because I would be okay with, various X-Men having very various opinions about the Cure. The Cure is an interesting thing to try to think about. What do you do with a mutant cure,
Yeah.
Because it would help a lot of mutants, and shouldn't they have the freedom to do that? But at the same time, I can sort of understand Magneto's point of view going like, well, there's nothing wrong with me. Don't treat me like a disease,
Yeah.
And of course, it plays quite obviously into the whole debate about homosexuality. Is it a choice, or are we born with that? And the X-Men writers take the obvious stance that if you're born with it, then it's not wrong, which is such a stupid stance to take with homosexuality. It's like, why homosexuality is not wrong? It's because it doesn't hurt anyone, and everybody, and the people involved usually tend to have fun and have better lives for it.
Yeah.
Why would you stand against that? Whether or not you're born with it makes absolutely no difference. And the thing I hate about that argument is that that's really condescending, because you're essentially saying that you tolerate homosexuals because they can't help themselves. And it's like, no. You tolerate homosexuals because they ain't doing nothing wrong.
Exactly. They're human beings like everybody else, so you tolerate them like everybody else.
And it's also, as somebody who's a visible minority, for those of you who don't know, I'm Asian. It's even more offensive to me, because you have all these people fighting us like, if we can just prove that we're born with it, we won't know any discrimination anymore. It's like, F you, buddy. Because I got parents of the girlfriends shunning me and disowning the girls because I'm Asian. And I'm pretty sure they knew I was born Asian, jackass.
It's funny you say that, because there is no racism in Canada.
But it's just that that very liberal attitude that people take towards the homosexual debate, as if homosexuals were the only one who have ever known discrimination, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so they approach it as if they're reinventing the wheel. And it's sort of like, no, the discrimination homosexuals are facing is very similar to other types of discrimination that have been going on since forever. And maybe, if we sort of looked at the problem as a universal acceptance problem, we might actually pinpoint what the real problem is instead of chasing red herrings. Like, are you born with it? And X-Men The Last Stand pisses me off because it pushes that mentality of if you're born with it, then it's okay. And it's like, I'm sorry, but they're close to identifying, a chemical and genetic problem with pedophiles. It will still never be okay.
Yeah. So on to plot number two.
The Phoenix.
Yes.
And that one's like 100% fan service. Because to a certain degree, at least the Mutant Cure storyline scores points for being pertinent to today's world.
Yeah.
You can relate to it. You might not agree with the politics. Like, I don't agree with them. But at least, it's like, well, actually, I see what they're going with. Phoenix storyline is pure fan service. It's like, yeah. Oh, well, there's a Dark Phoenix saga that everybody loves. Let's put it in there, even though it never really leads anywhere.
Yeah.
And the basic problem with that is that Scott Summers, played by James Marsden, is central to the Phoenix storyline.
Yes.
Not just in the comics, but in the way it's set up in the first two movies. He's her husband.
Yeah.
He's Jean Grey's husband. Of course he's going to be central to that. And, of course, he was busy filming Superman Returns, so he was only there for a third of the movie.
Yeah.
And for some reason, they decided to put him in the front third of the movie.
Yeah.
Where he's dispatched one third into the movie, and you're like, what?
Yeah, well, he has no more relevance to the whole story at all at the end there. And that's, if you're going to do fan service with the Phoenix Saga, you should actually have, him be the hero of that, and resolve that story, because he was a central character of it. Him and Jean Grey, of course.
Yeah.
So if you want to use him for a third of the movie, use him for the later third of the movie. He might come maybe as a, Deus Ex Machina thing, He's not with the X-Men anymore because he's pissed because Jean Grey's dead, and then, have him learn about, she's alive and she's causing trouble, and then show up, I'm not saying just have him pop at the end there when, you know, Jean Grey is killing everybody. And, you know, hey, I'm here all of a sudden. It's the first time you see me. But, you know, use him better if you only have a third of the movie. Not just, you know, have him dispatched at the beginning there and have him have no consequence in the story.
Yeah, I agree completely with you. Because the problem with what they did is that they booted him out in the first third and then had sort of Wolverine mysteriously replace him.
Yeah.
Which is weird because they build up the relationship with Cyclops, then he disappears, and then Wolverine sort of picks up where he left off, even though they, I mean, in fairness, he was already established as having an attraction to her in the first two movies, so it's not that awkward, but it's sort of like, why did you build up one character so the other character would have a payoff? It's very weird.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is, there's a lost opportunity there. Okay, so you have to work around the fact that James Marsden is only available for a third of the movie. Like you said, the last third makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Jean Grey's relationship with Cyclops, kind of vanilla. You know, they're a loving couple.
Yeah.
Whatevs. Wolverine's relationship with Jean Grey, kind of bland as well. He's attracted to her. She's sort of attracted, but not really interested. Been there, but done that.
Yeah.
Cyclops and Wolverine's relationship, super fun. It's buddy cop movie time. Everybody loves that in an action movie. It's fun. So why not have Wolverine do the search for Cyclops? You start off the movie, Jean Grey's dead, Cyclops left because he's all pissed off because his girlfriend died, the dream didn't come true, F you Xavier, I'm James Martin, I'm pissed off. And then they find Jean Grey, she's alive, and they're like, yay, it was like, where's Cyclops? Ah, nobody can find him. Oh, and then Wolverine's going like, yeah, I'm going to get that shin, you know? It's like, yeah. He's not in the role. And then she turns out to be evil. It goes like, oh, I can't control her because she doesn't really love me the way she loves Cyclops. So I have to swallow my pride and got to find Cyclops. And then do the search for Cyclops storyline, which allows to dispatch Wolverine to his own adventure. And so that he doesn't have to listen to all the platitudes that Storm will give him about not being a team player, yeah. Which we've heard for two movies in a row now.
That'd have been a great subtitle. X3, The Search for Cyclops.
Yeah.
Not ripping off The Search for Spock at all.
But I mean, it would have made sense. And then, you know, then you can dovetail it when he comes back, you know?
Yeah, I agree. That would have been, it makes so much more sense than, you know, at the end of X2, it's pretty much, you know, it concluded, you know, Wolverine even says, you know, she made a choice. She chose you as in, you know, she loves you, not me.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, you know, you have him, you know, be the woman beater that he usually is, because in every movie he beats up a woman. So you have Wolverine, again, killing a woman in the third movie and finishing it all. You're like, it's pretty lame.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that Cyclops and Wolverine's relationship would have been more interesting. But it's also, it would have allowed Wolverine to still be at the center of it, but instead of being at the center of it in a, like, I'm just, you know, the generic hero, it would have been in a way that relates to his character where he has to swallow his pride, where he has to go, like, I may have the hots for her, but she won't listen to me. She'll listen to that douchebag that I don't like. It would have been really awesome for the character. It would have been genuine character growth. And it would have split the story in a more natural way, because what's happening with the two stories is that the characters share the same space, but they don't share the same storyline, so that you have a scene like where Magneto and Jean Grey are sort of like standing next to each other, Magneto does his thing, and then Magneto's done doing his thing, and Jean Grey's going like, oh, what, is it my turn? Oh, brr, destroy, 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 destroy. It's like, why weren't you destroying before? She's just like patiently waiting her turn.
Yeah, it wasn't her turn yet, so you know.
And so moving them in separate geographical spaces would have actually solved that problem.
Yeah.
But getting back to the Jean Grey storyline, the Phoenix storyline, they freaking kill everybody.
Yeah.
They kill everybody. And it's like normally in a movie that wouldn't necessarily be a problem. I know some people find that dramatic. I don't. I hate it when they kill characters.
Especially comic book characters, because it happens in comic books all the time. And it's lost all its meaning, because they're going to come back. So even if you do it in a movie and you kill comic book characters in the movie, they'll come back. Mm. Really, they'll find a way.
And if they don't, it's even worse because I kind of like them and I want to see them in the next movie.
That's true. The death of the characters, they killed so many characters and they had like almost no meaning to me because they started on so early. It's like Cyclops is looking, he goes back to where Jean Grey died and he's there and he finds her and he dies. And it's like, oh, knowing comic books, like, this is what we're starting now. We're just going to kill off characters for effects. you know, that one kind of was like, really, you're getting rid of the character? That one kind of surprised me, as in, you know, you're getting rid of Cyclops now? That's really odd. But then when the deaths kept piling up and piling up, you're like, okay, this is ridiculous. They're just trying to add deaths for shock value, and it had no effect on me whatsoever. When Professor X died, I really facepalmed. I was like, not only you're killing characters, you're killing important characters that you can't make movies. You know?
It's a weird thing where they have a token scene at the end of the movie where they're at the funeral and like sort of doing a memorial for all the fallen X-Men, which is like half the freaking backyard now.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, first of all, I am tickled to death that the people who are buried like about 6 meters away from the actual school grounds. Like, so you new students, you know what happens to you if you don't toe the line. But
they're not buried. The memorial is right there. I don't think they have their bodies. Maybe they have Jesus.
Well, because they have tombstones.
They have tombstones. You don't need the body to have a tombstone, though.
Oh, that's true. But yeah, well, I think the problem is that there's no sense of consequence. Nobody mourns them. It's a thing. Like, Cyclops dies and everybody goes like, hey, Storm, Cyclops dead. And Storm goes like, why don't you pick a side, Wolverine? It's like no, absolutely nobody cares about poor Cyclops. Like, okay, but like, we're ranting quite a bit. I want to focus on the few things for me that did work in the movie.
Okay.
Because I didn't completely hate it. Like, I don't hate it nearly as much as the average comic book fan. I think it's bad. I think it's very disappointing. And I think a lot of the problems come from the fact that the production didn't want to wait for Bryan Singer, who had a really cool story to tell. And then so they got Matthew Vaughn in, and he started a movie, and then fans put pressure on him that he sort of left the project because he was not a fan. And so they brought in Brett Ratner. Now, Brett Ratner of Rush Hour fame, you know?
Oh, wow.
The sort of intelligent director you want for the most complicated X-Men movie yet. And, you know, Brett Ratner, it's not that he's not talented, it's that he doesn't really try very hard. He sort of does what the producers want him to do. He's just that sort of director. He gets a competent product out of the unholy mess of, you know, producer team meetings.
Okay.
And that's what you got with X-Men. It's like every producer wanted their favorite X-Men character to be in it, so he shoved them all in there and just sort of mixed the pot and just went like, there you go. but he's still a competent director to a certain degree, and there are some ideas in there that quite work. I like Angel. I know a lot of people don't, but I quite like Ben Foster as Angel. He comes off incredibly gay.
Yeah.
And I think that's great, because, of course, this specific X-Men movie is all about gay rights. And so Ben Foster manages to show up on screen, never say any lines like, I'm, like, gay, or, like, I'm a mutant, and I like a certain type of people. And like, none of those, like, double talks to make you think he's gay. He just shows up, and you're like, wow, gay.
Yeah, but that's the thing. If you're trying to make it a metaphor or a comparison for, you know, gay rights or stuff like that, it loses it when you're making the character gay as well as a mutant. I mean,
well, he doesn't do it as well. He just does gay, because the script never actually gives enough parallels for his character specifically, yeah, for you to sort of connect the dots. He just does it with his performance alone, and I think that was actually quite powerful.
I don't know. I you know, if you're trying to make a parallel between, like, you know, gay rights and mutant rights, and now you're having a gay mutant, I mean, I don't know.
He never actually, you know, no, maxed with a dude or anything.
I know, but like you said, he looked very, very gay.
Yeah, well, he plays it gay so that you get the analogy, because the screenplay won't connect the dots for you. I think that's actually a really smart acting decision on his part.
I don't usually get those, and you know me, I don't usually get those, but I could see exactly what's going on with, you know, the comparison between mutanthood and mutant rights and, you know, minority rights and discrimination and stuff like that.
No, but I mean with his character.
Yeah, but yeah, you didn't have to put it in addition to that, you know, oh, well, you know, if you don't get it, you know, I'm going to make this character gay to make the parallel even more.
It's not that they made the character gay, it's that he plays it gay.
Yeah, I know. That's, but still.
But his father's storyline actually kind of is sweet. The way that the father is actually well-meaning and wants to cure his mutanthood. And the guy's like, why would you want to cure that? And especially since I have, like, these gorgeous, like, super cool wings, you know?
Yeah.
And they do explore really, well enough the two points of view, the son and the father, where you kind of see where they're both coming from.
Especially,
you know?
Since isn't Angel one of the only mutant that's liked in the whole X-Men universe?
Well, in the comic book, yeah, I have no idea for the movie.
In the comic book, he's the only mutant that's like, because he looks like an angel. And you're making him the one that you want to cure? I don't know.
I don't have a problem with that. I'm not like, look, the movie universe is different from the comic book universe.
Yeah.
I don't really have a problem with that. And I thought it's nice because he has those gorgeous angel wings, you sort of have an immediate understanding of why this guy wouldn't want to be cured. But at the same time, he's a dude with wings, so I kind of see the father's point of view as well.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, that allows him to soar at the end, which is super heavy-handed as an analogy, but you know? Magneto has a couple of killer lines. They sort of betrayed his character, but he's still not a complete villain.
Yeah.
You mentioned Pyro going like, I would have killed Xavier if you wanted. Like, Magneto's reaction to that is actually quite lovely.
Yeah. And so, yeah, Magneto's like, yeah, don't you remember who you were in the second movie? Kind of close to that.
More than that. Because they build a lot about the idea that Magneto and Xavier have still maintained this fondness about their previous friendship.
Yeah.
And they build that a lot, and that's actually quite lovely.
Yeah.
And his, of course, sort of taking on Phoenix plays well into his character as well in that version where the X-Men want to suppress her abilities because she goes crazy, evil, nuts. And he's like, no. No. That's who you are. Be proud of that. And even if that means you're evil. And that's sort of nice and reckless. You know, I kind of like that.
Yeah.
What else did I like? I think that's it. I do want to talk about the alternate ending that Brett Ratner wanted to use and the producers went against, which actually would have fixed so many of the problems. Because the alternate ending was, so you have Magneto, same as the one we got, playing chess without his powers and sort of vibrating the piece barely to show that he might not have lost everything. And what you're supposed to have is that Mystique comes to meet him. And they play chess together, and he goes like, did you get it? And she was like, yeah, I got it. And then she pops out the sample of the mutant cure, and he takes it and smiles, and that's how it's supposed to end. Where the whole implication of it is that Magneto had orchestrated this entire mess with and that sort of that fake out with him not caring about Mystique, also that she could go inside the human facilities and actually steal a sample of the cure. Like, he was never actually going to kill the kid. He really wanted the weaponized source.
Yeah.
And it was all about him making his next bid, which would have led into a new movie and would have actually fixed a lot of the character problems. The character beats that don't make sense in the final product were probably written in a way that don't make sense because they were supposed to pay off with that alternate ending where you go like, oh, see, it felt off, but we knew what we were doing all along.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been... That would have been great. Wouldn't have fixed the good guys, though, when they were acting so loony. But at least the bad guys, which, you know, usually the cooler part of the movies.
Well, let's face it. The X-Men movies are a little bit like the G.I. Joe cartoon. You watch it for the baddies.
Yeah, exactly.
On that note, if you have any questions, comments you want to share with us, you can mail us at mail@idiomatic.com or post a comment at idiomatic.com. We're also on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. We're also... on iTunes. But don't worry, guys. Frank and Chris and all the bunch will be back soon enough.
See you next time, guys.